Hey guys, in this episode we chat with Adam Bruce. Adam is an active composer, clinician, and performer from Oklahoma. His compositions have been performed internationally as well as at Midwest and PASIC, and Adam was the director of percussion for Union Public Schools from 2014 to 2022.
Adam has played with multiple Oklahoma symphonies and DCI groups, including the Colts, Bluecoats, and the Cavaliers. Adam also taught with the Cavaliers, the Crossmen, Spirit of Atlanta, Memphis Sound, and Gateway Indoor.
He has a master's degree in percussion performance from Oklahoma City University and a bachelor's degree from Oklahoma Christian University in instrumental music ed, and he currently works as a store manager for Palin Music.
In this episode, we chat about incorporating accessories into your beginning percussion curriculum, preparing your eighth graders for the leap into high school, Adam's approach to front ensemble arranging, and much more. We hope you enjoy this episode and can gain some educational info along the way. So sit back, relax, and enjoy our conversation with Adam Bruce.
Hey guys, and welcome back to the next episode of Percussion Perspective. My name's Remy.
My name's Kevin.
And my name's Adam.
And today on the podcast, we've got a guest, Adam Bruce. We're going to do a interview with him today and talk about some stuff and get his perspective on percussion, if you know what I'm saying. So welcome Adam.
Thanks. Yeah, thanks for having me. It's gonna be fun.
Yeah, absolutely. Adam is, you know, we'll let him introduce himself here in a minute, but Adam is one of the first guys that we really wanted to interview whenever we started talking about having some guests on the podcast. And Kevin and I both look up to him, you know, as a percussion educator and a percussionist. And so, he was one of the first ones that we thought of. So yeah, welcome, man. And, take a second, introduce yourself if you don't mind.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. As a percussionist and percussion teacher and someone who's obsessed with all things percussion, this is the right place to be. I taught public and private school for 13 years before spending the last 2.5 years out of the teaching world and working in the private sector, doing running a music store, but still really involved in composition and going out to schools and working with kids. Still doing a lot of that, just looking for every excuse to either be talking shop percussion or actually doing it.
Yeah, that's cool. I know that probably was a little bit of a crazy transition there for a little bit, getting out of the teaching world and into the private stuff. But I really didn't know you until you were getting out of teaching, really. But it seems to me like you've maybe had a little bit more time for like performing and stuff after, since your hours are a little bit different now.
Yeah, definitely. Before I moved up, into the Tulsa area, 10, 11 years ago, I was playing pretty often in Oklahoma City, with Oklahoma City Phil. And then once I came up here, my teaching schedule just didn't allow any of that at all. And so now that I'm not teaching full time, I'm able to say yes a lot more often to playing around town up here.
Yeah. I think that's probably one of the Kevin's here, by the way, too. I just keep looking at him. that's probably one of the toughest things in like being a new dad too, but being a teacher and I just have to say no to performance opportunities a lot. I just don't have time for it, which is, there's more important things. So it's, you know, it ends up being fine, but it is a bummer sometimes. So I'm glad you're getting to do that. And like, you've got a lot of knowledge, so you can still get in, where you're working, you can still get in and see kids and clinic and things like that. So that's good that you're kind of getting to do the best of both worlds maybe for a bit.
Yeah. It's nice to be able to scratch that itch. And, and as far as doing clinics and stuff, that's part of my job now is going out and helping teachers and a lot of schools I go to, they don't have a percussionist on staff, or there's just one person. And so, you know, going and doing stuff that I would have done when I was teaching, like, let me, you know, change these heads for you or tune your concert bass drum and just pop in and try to be helpful in a very tangible way.
Yeah, that's good.
It's fun, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, cool. Go ahead, Kevin. Sorry, I forget.
Yeah, I was so kind of moving on just a little bit. We were going to talk about, you know, Remy and I have talked about our high school and college experiences as percussionists. So would you like to just kind of give the people a little bit of a background on your high school percussion experience and then kind of how your college experience went before you started teaching?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. So in high school, I grew up in Edmond. I went to Edmond Memorial High School, and none of the band directors were percussionists there. And so we had a series of different percussion techs that would come out during marching band. And a couple of years when I was in high school, we had an indoor drumline program too. And so we would glean from them what we could, and then we're kind of on our own for the rest of the time. And I didn't really take private lessons until I was a junior. And so those first couple of years of high school, it was all about marching band. And, luckily I was completely hooked in because the music was so great that we were playing. We did soundtrack from Jerry Goldsmith's The Mummy, which is an awesome soundtrack. And then my sophomore year, we did The Planets. So pretty hard to beat. Definitely had me, you know, hook, line, sinker. I don't know if I said those in the right order. I don't fish, but
yeah, I mean, I fish like once either a year, way. And you're probably good.
Maybe the point. Yeah. Point came across, but, yeah. And then, so we weren't doing any percussion ensemble in high school, and there wasn't anybody challenging us outside of marching season. But luckily in middle school, my middle school director and who started us was a percussionist and did a great job. We did tons of percussion ensemble. And so I really fell in love with that in middle school. And then as I got later into high school and I started to get a little more serious about it, probably the biggest single most influential part of that was, my dad got a random flyer in the mail. He was adjunct music faculty at Oklahoma Christian, and he got a random flyer, for a Juilliard summer seminar, percussion seminar. And, he was like, hey, you should make a recording and try out for this. And so just on a fluke, on a whim, I made some recordings and sent them in. It was like, he gave me the flyer like 2 days before it was due. And we just sent it in. I had no idea what it was, but I got accepted. And so that summer between my junior and senior year, in July, I went up there and we lived on campus at Juilliard. There was 15 kids from around the world. And it was completely transformative. It was a really awesome experience. And that's what really hooked me in. It's like, okay, this is my path. Before that, I was like, you know, I should be in like the Blue Man Group or Stomp. That'd be awesome.
Yeah.
And then after doing that seminar, it was like, not that those aren't like legit ways of playing percussion and performing. Sure. Those are awesome. But I was like, oh, okay, the concert side of things is... That's where, you know, I really love this and I really want to dive deeper, and decided to, yeah, study music in college.
What was something in that, like, do you remember anything specifically cool about that Juilliard camp that stuck out?
Yeah. I mean, it's been over 20 years. So a lot of the details are fuzzy, but a couple things I remember, Joseph Gramley, he led the camp and he did for a long time. He was at Michigan for a long time. Now I think he's at IU in Indiana, but he spent a lot of time working on accessories with us, which it was like, I only knew the basics. I didn't really know anything about accessories at all. And so that was really cool. And Glenn Velez taught us, he did a class with us on how to sing overtones, like how to make overtones come out of your voice.
Wow.
And it was amazing, and none of us were great at it, but it just opened your eyes to all sorts of new things, and it was really cool.
Yeah, that's got to be a super cool experience for, you know, like, a, you said it was in between junior and senior year, that that's got to be a really cool experience for like a young high school musician, especially if you hadn't had anything like that before. I had like a similar background where went to a good high school, but we didn't have like a full-time percussion person either. And so that's, I didn't know that. That's really cool.
It was, I was definitely I went from being like a big fish in a small pond to the opposite, because I was the oldest at that camp, but I was definitely like last chair. like, hey, let's let in this kid from Oklahoma and show him the big city.
Right.
So I learned a lot from all the other students, which is really cool.
Was that hard to like, like when you came back for your senior year, did you just feel like completely different? And like, you were like, not that you had like a big head, but like, you probably would have a big head coming back after doing something cool like that.
And like, in some ways it was hard. Mostly I was just excited to share what I knew. Even though we didn't have a percussion instructor, we had a really good percussion culture amongst the students. And like, two of my good friends had just gone and marched a summer of drum corps. And there were others who were really smart and good players. And so we had a strong nucleus of kids that were really good. So it didn't really, at least in my perspective, I don't think I was like a jerk or anything. I guess we should ask someone else. I don't know.
Yeah.
We'll have to interview some of your classmates or something.
Fair enough. Yeah.
And then do you want to just, you don't have to go super long, but how was your college experience? Where'd you go and how was that?
Yeah. So I did my undergrad at Oklahoma Christian University, which, again, also did not have a percussion instructor there. Very small school, very small music program. I went there because my parents were both adjunct faculty and I kind of grew up at that school, and my best friend was going there and he was going to study music. And so it all just kind of, all signs sort of pointed that way. But in the summers, I marched drum corps. So I marched for 4 summers that whole time from summer between high school, you know, through college. And so I took lessons at Oklahoma City University with David Steffens, who was principal percussionist in Oklahoma City Philharmonic for a long time. And I had started with him the year before, my last year of high school. And so I was able to, you know, take my lessons and continue to develop, you know, through him and a few other people who I took lessons from along the way. And so my experience there, you know, what I really benefited from was that there were no other percussionist music majors the whole time I was there, and which I missed out on that studio experience. Like, I really wanted that and didn't have that, but I kind of got that in the summers through drum corps. But it meant that I was the guy who played for everything. And so, you know, I was just, you know, every different kind of ensemble, I was the person who got called up to play. So I had no shortage of opportunities in that way.
I feel like that's how Remy and I, our experiences at OSU were kind of similar. I mean, there was a studio, there was like a group of people, but I felt like also Remy and I were both, there were still a lot of people, but maybe not too many that were willing to kind of do that same idea of playing for everything, playing for every chance you got. So I feel like we kind of had that same similar thing, playing for choirs and just random small things like that. So just...
Yeah, I always tell my students that was one of the things that helped me become a good performer, was just like being exposed to so many things. So it sounds like you got a lot of that there. And at a bigger school, like Kevin was saying, it's like we did, especially our first couple of years, the studio was really big. But yeah, it just seemed like the same, like my wife was one that was included. It was like the same 4 or 5 people kind of got called on to do most of the gigs, I was really thankful for, because it just exposes you to a lot of different genres and a lot of different playing and different circumstances. And, you know, now it doesn't matter if I have to play like tambourine for a choir or like timpani with a brass band it kind of makes you ready for anything.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it freed me up too. There's no football team. There's no marching band component. So it freed me up to start being a drum tech, a high school drum tech, and teach private lessons. And so I actually got hired back at my high school as the drum tech, which I don't recommend. to anyone to do that. Go somewhere else. It worked out. But I was doing all the early mornings and evening rehearsals and contests. And by age 19, I was all in teaching lessons and doing that all through college. And I don't think I would have been able to do that as much and cut my teeth learning how to do it, how not to do it, especially from that young of an age.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah, in our, go ahead.
We're going to have to get better at this. Two people interviewing one person.
Yeah.
We need little flags we can hold up.
Think from Casa Bonita.
We had a couple interviews. I'm probably saying the same thing that you are about to say. We had some interviews where we interviewed each other and talked about what we think made us so comfortable at teaching. And that was something we both had said was like, get a teching job in college, mm-hmm. no matter if you're going to teach a drum line of 3 kids or a drum line of 50. I mean, hopefully not 50, but being able to just get in front of those kids, and whether it's teching or it's lesson stuff, that's probably one of the best reasons that I think probably all three of us are just really comfortable teaching, especially at younger ages, because we were just able to do that. That's what you were going to say?
Yeah, I was given a really long leash too. I mean, there were a couple of years in there, I was still in college, where I was planning and rehearsing percussion ensemble and taking them to contest. And so I really got crash course before student teaching on, you know, what's it like on the other side as a teacher?
Right. And we, like Kevin and I both teched at the same program as soon as he graduated, it was like, okay, well, I'm going to step into that role now. And, Trish Bovenshin was kind of both of our mentor. And I would say she gave us pretty fair rein to do what we thought we needed to do. Or
she's smart like that.
Yeah. Keyword thought though. It's like, maybe she probably sat back and she's like, well, they think they need to do that, but it'll be better if they figure it out on their own than if I just shut them down immediately. When I was in grad school, I got to take one of their groups to percussion ensemble contests and stuff too. So yeah, you said the phrase cutting your teeth, and that's exactly what it is when you're getting that experience. I think it's so much more valuable to get that experience, during college than it is to just like sit in a practice room for hours and hours and hours. And not that practicing isn't important also, but, if you're really wanting to be an effective teacher, it's just like that experience is the most important thing. So
absolutely.
Sounds like we all kind of had real parallel, maybe like percussion upbringings, which is cool.
Yeah,
definitely.
Adam, do you feel like when you were maybe younger or getting into college, do you feel like you were one of those kids that had to work really hard, or did you have like a bunch of natural talent you could kind of lean on? Just interested in that.
I feel like I'm right in the middle. Everyone in my family does music, and I just grew up doing that. We all did. It's all we've ever known. And so, in some ways, you get those kids as beginners, and you got a leg up. You know, I'd been playing piano since kindergarten and singing in the Edmund Children's Chorus and doing stuff like that. And so I felt like, you know, I did have talent coming into it, from my parents who are both musicians for sure. And, but I in sixth grade, I was not the best in my class. I had a freak of nature beginning class. And there were like 5 or 6 of us who were all kind of came in with a bunch of musical background. And so I practiced a lot because we all would duke it out. And, the girls would always beat me. And so I felt like even though I did have talent because of that specific situation, I was always practicing and, you know, trying to move to the top in those earlier years.
Yeah. Did your parents make you take piano lessons? Like, was that there or was that something that you wanted to do? Or
it was the expectation. My mom is a piano teacher. And it's something we all did. And so I never loved it. You know, I got decent, but, you know, by the time I was starting to really get into percussion around eighth grade, that piano kind of, you know, fell away.
Yeah.
So I never asked to take piano lessons. That was just the expectation.
Yeah. You're five now, so you're going to take piano. Yeah.
Pretty much.
Well, I always talk to people about that. And, I didn't do piano lessons or anything. And now as an adult, I really wish that my parents would have made me do that. But then, you know, the other side of that coin is I had multiple friends, that I grew up with, playing soccer. I played soccer for a long time, and they all took, you know, their parents made them take piano lessons, and all of them, it's kind of like one of those things, your parents make you do it, so you don't want to do it. If it's your own idea, it's like a lot more powerful. So it's like none of those guys ended up doing band for more than a year or two. They just, it seemed like it kind of burnt out music for them really early. So I'm always curious when I hear of people, you know, because that's kind of the ideal thing, is like start piano and then you can move on to anything else in that. Right. Most of that knowledge is at least halfway transferable. But it just seems like there aren't a whole lot of success stories from that, but you're one of them. So
it's a tricky thing to thread. And now as a parent, you know, my oldest kid is 9 and she does piano lessons. It's something that, you know, we kind of tread lightly around it. Like, we want her to do it. We think she needs to do it. It's good for her, but we don't want to push it to the point where she doesn't enjoy it. You know, right. It's a hard balance to make.
Yeah. And even with my daughter, that's like 2, I'm constantly like, hey, do you want to go play drums with me? But then it's like, okay, let's chill out on that, because you're going to have plenty of time to make that decision on your own. So,
right. Right.
I have 2 dogs.
You do,
yeah. do they do lessons?
Yeah.
No. They're not.
They only play cluster chords. It's weird.
Oh, cool.
Okay.
All right.
Okay. This next question is mine. All right. Calm down. wait, no, this is yours. This is awkward. Go ahead. Sorry, buddy.
I'm just sorry. I can't read. You can
get it together, guys. Come on. You can
give us a review.
He just logs off.
So we'll kind of switch gears a little bit to the educational aspect. You know, when we were thinking about having guests, we always want things to still be educational and have more of a conversation about topics that young percussionists, young band directors without percussionists, any person that listens to this can still take away some very concrete, useful info. So we asked you some topics that you would want to maybe chat about. So let's start off with introducing accessories in your beginning percussion class. I know for me, and probably Remy, but I'll quit talking for him, that it's like a hard concept to get in there, because you're always wanting to, you know, get all the snare rudiments down that you can get to, trying to force mallet reading and all the other things. So, since this was your idea, do you want to kind of start chatting and bring up the conversation of how you did this when you taught?
Yeah. I would say the first 5 years of my teaching full time, I didn't do enough of working accessories in with beginners, and I always, you know, they get into the next year and I would always look back and regret it and say, I got to do better next year. I got to make sure I get this one in there. And so once I finally, took the time to kind of like chart out months, basically, like, these are my big goals for the months. And, you know, I always have like a weekly goal, or, you know, by this point, I like to be around here in the book, or, you know, get to this scale roughly by this point in the semester. You know, I would work in planning different accessories into that. And I would find that when I would do that and be like, okay, I'm just going to take the last half of class on this day to do triangle, whatever, that I would always neglect that plan and I would always push it off. Even though I planned it, I still wouldn't do it. So I started doing, like, dedicating a whole entire class period to like, I would pick two accessories and like, we're doing triangle and tambourine all day today, because I would always be like, oh, we can just, you know, we can keep doing a few more minutes on scales and run out of time. So I would couple them up and take an entire class period. And it seems like it might be easy to run out of stuff to talk about if you're introducing the triangle for the first time and trying to split an entire class period. But it was important to me to get it in every kid's hand. And the last 8 years of my teaching in Tulsa, I always had really big beginner classes, 25 to 30 kids, and it was just one big class. And so it took time to get everybody a chance to hold. So one of the biggest or one of the most important things that I found with introducing accessories that would get the kids more interested was to teach them a technique that they weren't going to need yet, like something a little bit more advanced that they're not going to see in their middle school music, maybe until eighth grade, but makes them more interested in an accessory. You know, so they're not just like, when can we get back to the drums? But, like with triangle, after sort of, training them and grilling them on how to hold it, because so many kids they can't remember how to hold a triangle clip the proper way, or really training them on that, making the shape with their hand without the clip, and then eventually having grip races, like, okay, who can get the proper grip in under 10 seconds and whittle it down, and teaching them like how to muffle the triangle while they're playing it, or rolling in different corners of it, or getting a little bit more detailed than what they're going to need right away seemed to help to get them to lock into it and care a little bit more about it. With tambourine, I've never been great at the thumb roll. I don't know. My like ridges in my thumbprint aren't pronounced enough. I don't know. I'm going to blame it on something I can't control.
You just got to soak your hand for a little bit. Like
that's right.
Get it all pruney. Yeah.
Just steal the oboist little pill bottle and soak your thumb in it.
Yeah.
Showing them thumb rolls, it's amazing. Some of the worst players that have like the worst technique with just basic percussion, they can thumb roll all 360 around the tambourine time, and it never failed. Every year there was a kid who was really good at that, and maybe they were kind of sitting like towards last chair regularly, and there was no pep in their step really for percussion, but they could find they could be actually really good at that thing that some of the top players couldn't do right away. Those types of things, going a little bit deeper than necessary from the get-go, seem to get kids to buy into and be more excited for playing accessories. So I mentioned triangle, tambourine, crash cymbals, suspended cymbal, concert bass drum. Those are the ones it's like, I got to get to these five every year, no matter what. And, occasionally, we might have time for something else. Like, how does an egg shaker work? And that's a really hard coordination to get, at first, but stuff that you don't take time to teach until it's like, oh, we really need someone to do this right now. Try to get out ahead of that.
Yeah. That's been my last 4 years or whatever. So, I definitely am going to take the time to plan out for this semester of class period. And, I was going to ask you, but you kind of already answered the question. What is your like list of, you have to cover those aux instruments, but you said triangle, tambourine, sus, crash, and bass drum. Those be the five. Okay.
Those are like the non-negotiables for me. And with bass drum, showing them right away, different playing spots. Like, hey, if you've got eighth notes, play closer to the middle. Teaching them how to roll, even though they're not going to roll on the bass drum in seventh grade, or, reach around the back to muffle. If you're ending with a piece that it's like a march and it's got a short note at the end, those types of things, pay attention to if they wrote a half note or a quarter note. And, I would go overboard with muffling on bass drum, like teach them like, hey, you got to pay attention to this long note and then muffle it right here, or muffle this much or that much. because this is this type of a piece, and just really try to get them thinking when their parts are really basic and they can learn it in like one rehearsal or two rehearsals and they're going to spend 2 months on it, go way deeper to keep them engaged.
Yeah. And that's something we've talked about on the podcast in the past is like, you know, if as their teacher, like they're looking up to you for basically all, or not basically, just all their percussion instruction. And if you make something seem important to you, then it's going to be important to them, you know? And so I like that outlook of like, you know, a lot of people, I don't know, I'm just thinking about like middle America dad, like they're like, oh son, what are you playing in the beginning band concert coming up this tonight? And the kid's like, triangle. And he's like, oh my gosh, like
no, that's my boy.
Yeah, exactly. Like disappointed.
We took you
dad.
Off the football team for this.
right.
Exactly.
But it's like, no, actually getting a good sound out of the triangle is really hard. And hey dad, do you want to try to figure out how to hold, like you talking about having the races. Like I love that. We just had a beginning band concert this last week, and you know, like for a couple weeks up to it, I was like teaching two or three kids to like play this accessory instrument and two or three kids to play this one. So they're kind of in groups, and yeah, it's like literally right before the concert started, I'm like backstage, you know, going, making sure everybody is good. And then some kid's like, Mr. Thornton, how do you hold this triangle? And so it's just like a constant battle, but I like that kind of like teaching them some more advanced techniques or whatever to kind of get them to buy in a little bit more. That's really smart.
Well,
yeah. And when you're at a school where there's not a percussion teacher, you know, if whoever's teaching the class, they're not a percussionist, they know just a couple specific things like that. And, you know, rehearsing their band and, you know, pay attention to that, like take a moment to jump down off the podium, walk through the middle of your band and go all the way to the back and show them a cool specific thing that will at least get you another week's worth of attention from the percussion in the back if they don't have anybody else paying attention to them.
Yeah.
Do you try to ever, we talked about this a while back, about timpani. Do you ever hit timpani, or did you ever in beginning percussion? Yeah. 'Cause for me, I feel like I never would have time. But then I also know that right around the corner when they get back from summer is like all region auditions and they have to play timpani.
Exactly.
And it's like, oh, so, and sometimes you would also get, you know, one of the beginning band pieces you might play at the end of the year might have a timpani part. So you can either not have them play it, but obviously you want them to. So did you ever get to timpani, or was that ever part of your plan?
Once I kind of got my stuff together and was planning and like working these things into my curriculum and, you know, making myself consider it a non-negotiable, I would actually pick a whole week and be like, this is timpani week. And, usually I've never been part of a district where the seventh grade timpani audition was more than two drums. It's always just been two, as far as I've experienced. But introducing them to the full range, five timpani and, printing out worksheets and having them fill it, like memorize the sizes. And, I remember when I was in middle school, we had to memorize the pitch ranges for the basic four timpani. And, that was a part of a written test that we had to do, which was a lot, but, it's helpful for sure. I'm pretty sure in the Mark Wessels books, that there's some like two drum etudes, maybe even some timpani stuff in the back, fresh approach to beginning percussion, or to snare drum and to mallet percussion. But, those two drum etudes, I skipped those for years. And then I kind of started to figure out like, hey, this is going to help prepare for timpani.
Yeah.
Have them, you know, moving side to side, moving their hands together or keeping their hands apart. And, you know, using those little lines, to teach the basics of timpani and, you know, get them comfortable moving around and, you know, not always, obviously nobody's going to have enough timpani to have all their beginning percussionists play timpani or the room. much less have the space for it. So, you know, you can have kids sit on the floor or whatever, or something that I got really into doing with honor band prep when I'm like, you got a whole class and we're working on timpani is we would do timpani chairs. We would take two chairs and sit them next to each other, but turn them in to a V and then, you know, play on the top of the backs of the chairs. It's a horrible sound, but it's a good way just to get used to moving back and forth when you don't have enough instruments.
Yeah, I would have them do their pads. So if we, mm-hmm. if we had enough pads, kind of set them up, I mean, we wouldn't ever have enough. Sometimes we'd kind of be like secretly stealing some of the other grade levels pads, but yeah, setting them up, at least they're in that, like you said, the motion of moving side to side. And the Wessels book does have some of those good little etudes. He also, backing it up just a hair, goes into depth. Mark started to like include in the new the dual book he created, Beginning Percussion Class. Mm-hmm. He'll throw in like a little lesson on like tambourine or triangle to try to just kind of make sure that you're hitting that, and then he'll have a little percussion ensemble like Lightly Row. He made it into a little percussion ensemble that then includes
cool.
that accessory and all of the accessories that, you know, he's included up into that point. So pretty beneficial there too.
Definitely. Yeah. It's so easy to skip over that stuff and just try to get to the next flam rudiment, but it's really, that's what they have to know for seventh grade.
Yeah.
And so it's better to get out ahead of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was just about to say because I started using that new Wessels book this year. And so, and like we got them and, right when school started. So I really didn't have a whole lot of time to really like proof through it and like plan. Mm-hmm. So it's like kind of going through it with them at the same time. And it's like, you know, tambourine shows up and I'm like, Mark, I don't have time for this. What are you talking about? Like we're trying to learn downstrokes. What do you mean? Anyway, and now it's like, I'm looking back like, okay, I already have like a way better idea of how I'm going to use this book next year.
Yeah, that's cool.
But yeah, just get, and then like you said, it's kind of like, I really struggle with it. Like I really want them to be super great at snare drum and super great at mallets. And I run out of time for timpani. I feel like it's probably been about half and half, like 50%, which I haven't been teaching for a very long time, but about half of the years I make it to timpani. And yeah, I just do the same thing, like do a week, you know, maybe mm-hmm. around spring break or something, when I feel like everybody's kind of like jiving on snare and they're not horrible at mallets anymore. And so we'll do a week on timpani, maybe leading up to spring break or something. And then sometimes it's like, man, we've just, whatever concerts came up or whatever snow days we had that ruined things. It's like, we're about to have a week like that right now, I'm afraid. Yeah, it's just hit and miss really. But you said you made it a non-negotiable to yourself, which is like a really good way of thinking of it, I think.
Thanks. Well, yeah. Anything else you want to compliment?
Yeah. Yeah.
No. And with timpani, it's, you know, it, even for high school players, last thing, then we can move on, but, you know, playing timpani well, you have to use a different type of stroke. And so I always want to make sure that I had, you know, the majority of the kids doing really well with the rebound strokes and downstrokes and not using too much arm, long before, like, okay, now on timpani, you do need to move your arms a little bit more. You've got this enormous drum that you've got to make the whole thing, the whole bowl resonate.
Yeah.
And your tiny little sixth grade wrist is not going to do that. And so being, you know, them being able to understand that concept and separate it from the training they've already had, I think is important to mention as well.
Yeah. Cause you're like now for something completely different and
yeah.
like, oh, but oh, by the way, it uses a different clef. And, that was one question I had for you. Do you jump right into timpani with like, here's bass clef or do you just give them like, you know, like a little two drum etude or something and just say, don't worry about the note names. Just look at high and low, or how do you approach that?
for a long time, I did that second, like just worry about high and low, what's higher on the staff, what's lower on the staff. And then I decided, well, I had a couple of years where my beginning class period was like an hour and 10 minutes every day, wow. Which was great. Awesome.
Yeah.
And so when I started to have that schedule, then I decided from the beginning of the school year, I'm teaching the grand staff, like they're reading piano, like bass clef and treble clef. Two ledger lines below, two ledger lines above, C up to shining C, and just tried to get bass clef in from the get-go. So it wasn't this thing that became resisted later on.
Right.
Because that was usually, I would find that with quite a few kids. They would resist learning bass clef.
They're already, you know, like have an aversion to reading melodies because they can't look at their hands and play this, and then it's like, oh, by the way, there's this other clef that's like just a little bit different than treble clef, and they're
really
like,
close, but
it's like literally two notes off. But
this is torture,
And they're like, but I hate this now. So that's our one thing that I've been struggling with recently is just like my schedule, and we went to a 7-hour schedule, so our hours are 45 minutes right now. And like for a percussion class, that means it's like 35 minutes, you know, when you're like taking a few minutes to set everything up. And so, it's just really hard to make it through everything, but hour and 10 would be pretty awesome if that could happen.
Sweet.
But these tips are all really, really great for whatever length of time you've got. The next one that you had kind of mentioned, the other topic, was prepping eighth graders to kind of make that leap into high school and talking about kind of what you did to prepare them. So do you want to talk about that for a little bit? And, you know, we've already touched on some of it, kind of trying to future proof your kids, but.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, every program everywhere, eighth grade kids have a lot of trepidation about jump into high school and marching band and, you know, being with kids older than them. And there's just a lot of that that's baked into it. And that's how it is. And, I felt that myself when I was in eighth grade, I remember that feeling. And so I tried to come up with ways to get out ahead of that. And one of the things that I found really helped prepare kids playing wise for high school was, baking in sort of extended techniques into the typical concert band warm-up, to where the kids don't have to be me pulling them out into another room to be getting better. And so like on mallets, you know, if the eighth grade band is warming up and they've got some, you know, standard scale pattern, bum, 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 or whatever, don't let your percussion kids just play that exact same thing, because that is way too slow. It's boring. They were playing that in they should have been playing that in sixth grade at that speed. And so you're, you know, while like for, you know, brass, especially, or kids who have switched over to, you know, bass clarinet or bassoon, like that's extremely beneficial, of course. For percussion, it's not, it's boring. And so you can cook in some ways to help them continue to develop their hands while still participating with the band. The quickest go-to thing is to have them play their scales like that in octaves, right hand, left hand at the same time, an octave apart, you know, playing the scale. And that's absolutely something they'll have to do in high school, whether they're in the front ensemble or, you know, just playing high school concert band literature. That's going to come up a lot with bells or vibraphone. Percussion ensemble, you're absolutely going to see that. So get them used to, you know, playing in octaves. If you've got limited room and kids are already sharing instruments and they can't do that, then have them play double strokes, boom, which is definitely harder on mallets than on drum pads. So that's going to develop their wrists more. And you know, for the kids who are more naturally inclined to be on a drum, they get that little they get a bite of the dangling carrot of, oh, we're doing double strokes.
Yeah.
And it's helping everyone's wrist develop. And then, another thing to do is by the time you're getting to eighth grade, moving into high school on mallets, everything you've played is probably pretty easy to get around the keyboard on and pretty functional. But in high school, that's not always the case. And it can be uncomfortable to move around between the sharps and flats and the naturals and the different manuals. And so, kids need to get comfortable with moving their hands fast on mallets and not just on drum pad. And so take the exact same scale pattern and have them fill it in with sextuplets. And they have, you know, half of a sextuplet on each note. And that's going to do two things. It's going to get them moving their hands faster on mallets, which they need to start getting used to. But also, you know, with it being an odd number, being a triplet, they're going to be changing. They have a different leading hand on every single note, you know, right, left, right. And then if they have to move up to a sharp, then it's the left hand leading and then back and forth. And so changing upper to lower manuals on opposite hands every single time, it's a twofold benefit. So those are things just with that one very simple scale pattern. That's three different things that will really help your kids.
Yeah. So, I have not those exact things, but I've done some things like that. So my,
what are you laughing at? I was going to talk, but it's fine.
Oh, okay. Well, it's my turn now. I raised my flag. The sopapillas are on the way.
Yes.
Anyways, so how do you implement that? Because that's what I have trouble with is like, I know you listen to the podcast some, so I don't know if you've heard me complain about it or not, but like my seventh and eighth grade classes happen at the same time. So I'm like seeing my seventh grade, you know, each of them I see 2 to 3 times a week. So I've always just had trouble. Like, I just don't get to see the kids enough to have time to actually work on, you know, like a daily drill that they can put in with their concert band or the,
I had that exact, oh, sorry.
Oh, go ahead. I was going to say, or the way that our middle schools are structured right now, like we're busting at the seams, which is a great problem to have, but it's like our eighth grade band is practicing upstairs in this old janky concert hall on like, you know, 4 xylophones and a practice marimba, because that's all that would fit in the elevator to get upstairs type of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's like, we're kind of limited by the space and the time, but anyway, yeah. So how would you implement that? Do you spend like the first couple weeks of eighth grade, kind of like talking about, here is a daily drill that you're going to do when I'm not pulling you out, you know, for rehearsal? Or
exactly. Yeah. I had that same situation my last 8 years. Seventh and eighth grade met on top of each other on different campuses. And so I was only, you know, at best seeing them 3 days a week. And so I would try to teach those basic ideas at the very end of seventh grade and then come back to it. And like the first couple of weeks of eighth grade, sort of relearn those things. And then I would write it out. I would write out those three different options and give it to whoever the eighth grade band director was, and tell them like, hey, if you'll just, you know, call this one out today and then, you know, this one tomorrow, or, you know, switch them between those and talk to the person who was actually directing that ensemble and be like, hey, will you please, you know, have them do these today? And situations where there's not enough keyboard instruments or the space is really limited, I would write out sort of a similar things that could go on snare drum or on an accessory, to, you know, cook into the daily ensemble warm up. That's going to accomplish the same ideas on what a different instrument would need.
Yeah.
Kind of like with the front ensemble, you know, like having like kids are playing rack or auxiliary, then, you know, you write parts for them that will match what everyone's doing on mallets.
Sure.
That's sort of an idea.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I like it. That's all really good ideas.
I think you'd have to have a pretty open, like good solid like eighth grade band director to be on board with all of that. And I have that where I'm at, so I'm not saying my staff. I have great staff with me. They love percussion, like, you know, Mary. Like loves percussionists.
Well, and they would see that as like me helping them keep the percussion engaged on the warmups.
Yeah.
And so it was a win-win.
Yeah. And I'm imagining if I was like a band director listening to this, I wouldn't want to be trying to get my band to do scales and like hearing six tuplets on the marimba. Like, I feel like, like if you've actually implemented that, is it like, is that pretty distracting? Because I could imagine that wouldn't be very clean. I mean, unless they got really, really good at it. But
it wouldn't be clean for a while. But from a distance, it would just sound like they're rolling.
That's true. Yeah. Yeah.
Because you know, with all the different
inexact rhythms, it would just all sound like a roll. That makes sense. Mm-hmm. I didn't think about
that. And they probably, you know, most of the time they can't even hear it from, you know, if it's a small room and you've got the front row is right there on top of you.
Right. That's a good idea, though. I like that. I like that. I like those ideas.
Well, anything else, Adam, on that leap to high school?
Yeah, I mean, on the, you know, I was talking about mallets, but on the snare drumming side of things, you know, I think it's really good to work on kind of reintroducing and refocusing on two height, like really being good with two height drumming. You know, low taps and accents. I think it's good to introduce some kind of a basic eighth note based syncopation that goes over the bar for them to start to get used to that kind of a thing. And you know, like one, te, te, four, te, te, three, something where they're really having to focus on tapping their foot and the accent pattern doesn't match that. Something basic, but because when they get thrown into high school, if they're having to learn cadences and stuff right away, it's going to be really hard if they are not comfortable with those types of syncopations. I think also doing a lot of triplet rhythm variations, like eighth note triplets or quarter note triplets. That stuff is all over the place in marching band and percussion ensemble. And even high school, like honor band auditions.
Yeah.
And so that's something that, you know, isn't really worried about with, or you're not going to encounter that much in middle school literature for concert band pieces. And so, you know, just getting them really comfortable with different types of triplet variations is really helpful. And then there's, you know, flam rudiments, you know, flam taps, flam paradiddles. Those, coming back to those and building up some dexterity and some speed, I think is really great. And then I think there's different schools of thought. See what you guys think about this on roughs. How do you guys teach roughs? How do you introduce the two-stroke rough? Is it closed or open?
Oh God.
So I what I do is I tell them that it is like a flam, but then from there it kind of depends on the kid. Like you definitely have you talked about like dangling the carrot with double strokes. Personally, I think that roughs sound better open. And so if a kid can do it, I tell them it's like a flam, but you diddle the grace note. Mm-hmm. And then, but it's like, but if you can't get that to sound clean, then you can just buzz the grace note, you know, like it ends up sounding like a flam with a buzzed grace note. That's how I go about it. And then I already kind of have those kids highlighted in my mind of like, you're one that would be able to play it open. You're one that would be able to play it open. And then we just, you know, we just try it as a group and try to work up that speed, starting mm-hmm. with like, you know, left, left, right, rest, rest, left, left, right, rest, rest. And then just kind of getting faster and faster until it just becomes one motion.
Yeah.
Okay. So you're a open.
I guess.
See, that's the thing open. With me. Sometimes I'm like, well, I don't know, however I feel today. I mean, it makes sense that when you're thinking about, you know, four note roughs and then three note roughs, that you're going to play those open. Right. I mean, so then why not a two note be the same thing? It may also depend on the style of music that you're playing. I think can determine that a lot. But I think if we're talking like eighth grade honor band music, I think I most of the time try to tell them to play it open.
Okay. Yeah.
Because that's like in the last one, our eighth graders just played, it had a couple of like three note drags in it, or roughs, however, whatever we want to name them. And so it was like that one was going to be open. And then I literally had a kid ask me, like, well, why is the two one not open too? And I was like, well, I don't know, kid. Don't ask me that. but so where do you fall on that?
With two stroke roughs, for beginners and in seventh grade, I would always have them keep it closed. And I would describe it the same way you did, Remy, like play it like a flam, but you buzz the grace note.
Yeah.
And then in eighth grade, I would then work on doing open two stroke roughs, three stroke roughs. I think that's more like it. That's always going to be open, but what sticking do you use?
Yeah.
Right, left, left,
right, left, right. Left, right, baby.
Yeah.
Right, left, left, yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
Unless you're on timpani or something, you know.
True. Yeah. And then it's left, right, left, right.
Yeah.
And that can different scenarios can change. I mean, we all three know that. Like if it's a slower pace, why didn't I just use the word tempo?
We have a musical word for that, but
if they're playing slow, it could change. The sticking could change, but I think generally we're Remy and I are both on like the right, left, left, right.
I like that one.
I think my challenges with going in from the high school into eighth grade into high school is like, this is the last chance I have with them as like a class, you know, cause by the time they're in high school, it's like, you're done getting to like see them every day and go through stuff. And so, like you said, like trying to get them a little bit stronger on the rudimental side of things, passing out the drumline packet and trying to get them to understand that stuff. Have you done formalit stuff by this point with your eighth graders?
Yeah. Eighth grade is where I would start on that. And, occasionally if I had a really bright class, then we would work on it at the end of seventh grade, just introducing the grip. But, that's another thing I didn't mention on like the basic, if you're doing basic scale pattern stuff is, you know, have kids do their inside mallets, and playing in octaves and inside mallets, or play if they're, you know, you're working on your single independence, just your inside mallets, alternating, play it just like the band is bum, 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 bum. Play it like that if you're using the inside two mallets for four mallets. But yeah, eighth grade year round, we would take a few minutes and work on every, you know, pretty much every time I saw them, be like, okay, today we're just working. We're sitting on the floor and we're just doing right hand double verticals.
Yeah.
For 3 minutes and then we're moving on. But yeah, I would always keep it really basic. You know, it seemed like maybe every year there was one kid that was like, oh, I learned the first half of YOLO After the Rain.
Yeah.
And they haven't even introduced any of those concepts yet, but they're just, you know, one of those freak of nature kids. But yeah, like the very basic stuff. I wanted kids to feel really comfortable with that, because most of the time, the majority of that class is going to end up in the front ensemble as freshmen. Kind of like a just standard thing. And so you want them to have that. And if they do end up in the drumline, I still want them to have that because they're not going to get that training in the front ensemble.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So either way, I, you know, want them to have that foundation.
Yeah. You're never going to.
When I was growing up, I didn't even hear of four mallets until high school.
Yeah. I don't think I really even did it till like my junior or maybe sophomore year. So yeah.
I played C refractions for my college audition. That was my first like senior year C refract. And I don't even think I played it well.
I did not know that.
Somehow they had mercy on me. And now I'm, you know, giving it to like eighth graders or whatever, mm-hmm. or freshmen mm-hmm. And I'm like, hey, you're already ahead of me, man. So
you're the only person that's ever auditioned for college using that piece.
Dude, probably.
That's hilarious. Well, yeah, that's a lot of good info. That's a lot of good stuff. Do you have anything else about leap? I mean, this is it, you know, if we don't say it now,
this is your last chance.
Well, so my last 4 or 5 years teaching, I got to a point before the pandemic where the numbers, I felt like my quality control, like I couldn't really have it where I wanted it, because I would have between 110 and 120 percussionists from 6th to 12th grade. And it was like, I just couldn't teach everything I wanted. So I created this little system. I called it benchmarks. And there was level one, level two, level three that I designed to be for the middle years of your band experience, 8th grade, 9th grade, 10th grade. And I incorporated these types of things into it. Like, how do you continue to build your skill in those specific years? And so I've got all that material, and if anybody ever, you know, wants it, I'm happy to send it to you. Anybody that's listening, but,
we're both raising our hands.
The kids would test it. They'd have to record themselves playing it with the metronome, and they'd have to pass off on certain ones. And it became a way to kind of do quality control, but also help 8th graders going to 9th grade. And it would be kids move at their own pace. The top kids would burn through an entire year of content in the first semester. And then other kids, it would take a year and a half to get through the first year of stuff. But that was something that I was glad I took the time to figure it out. And I really needed to, because I felt like I was just losing so much, and I wasn't teaching the kids everything I felt like I needed to teach them without that structured thing. So
it's crazy.
Anybody wants that? Send me an email.
Yeah, it's crazy how much percussion education has to happen outside of the band day. Like, outside of your day. It's like, welcome to band. You're also going to have all of the stuff that you're not going to learn in class. So you're going
to
have...
And you won't have it at home to practice.
And you're not going to have it at home. You have this little piece of rubber you can practice on. And that's... Yeah, it's crazy.
And be grateful for it.
Cool. Well, that's good info. Remy, were you going to say anything just then?
No.
Say anything.
Just really just enjoying the conversation. Yeah. I'm learning a ton right
same.
Now.
So. I'm taking notes. Never have this guy on again. just kidding. So we had an email a while back that was asking about an episode on front ensemble arranging. So maybe
like wanting us to do an episode, right?
Yes.
We don't have an episode.
Right.
Okay, yeah.
Right,
I'm not that good at that.
So maybe we could make this another episode with you, or, basically just, I think just the, how to get started in that and how to just begin the process when you get the wind music and you start putting that together. Would you be able to talk a little bit about arranging for the front?
Sure. Yeah. And I mean, I can kind of go in broad strokes for the sake of time, but, I mean, I think, you know, when I started out arranging, it was just for the battery. And I would sit and listen to the source material over and over and over, and it would be the number one most played thing on my iPod.
Would you tell people what an iPod is?
There you go.
I'm
yeah.
Just kidding.
Yeah. Go to some museum. And you'll be able to find
it's
it,
I'm
sure.
It's the thing we all have that but, used to not be able to call anybody.
Yeah. Right. A quick sidebar. My first show that I wrote for, I was on tour marching drum corps, and I was writing it by hand, and then on a free day or a laundry day, I'd pay someone to do my laundry, and I would walk through town and find the post office because you didn't have smartphones, and I would copy it. And then I would mail it to one of the band directors. And first time I did this, I realized that the pencil was not dark enough to copy. Oh. And
have to trace over it again.
It was crazy. Yeah. And then I got in the Conestoga wagon and continued along the dusty trail.
That is insane.
Yeah. But so when I first started arranging for marching band, marching percussion, I would listen to the source material and just memorize it, internalize it completely. And I don't do that anymore. I don't feel like I need to. I know, you know, what needs to go here and there just kind of by instinct and by doing a lot. But I would say live with the source material and then find somebody who's older than you that does this, that you may know or you may not know, and just ask, can I have a score from a couple of years ago to study how you did this, and ask somebody to study one of their scores. So, you know, a show that you saw in person, and caught your attention, like, oh, that's like about the same size as the school I'm writing for. And they sound really good. And, it, you know, don't try to get the, you know, the score to the Blue Devils front ensemble, whatever, because it's going to be the worst thing that you could study when you're first starting out. You know, find somebody that's writing for a similar size school that's been doing it for a while and that they've had enough trial and error to have success with it. That's my you know, most basic starting point is study someone that's already been doing it and try to get your hands on a score. So you can figure out, how did they do it and make notes. Oh, when it was the saxophones and mellophones playing this, they doubled that melody with chimes and crotales, and that was a really cool choice. Or, oh, use an ostinato in the low end of the marimba whenever the low brass are playing, and just like pace out, or, you know, like write things down. Don't just listen and go with your heart. Yeah. You know, what's going to be the coolest, fastest run up the marimba? But like, be meticulous. What pairs well within the front ensemble with, you know, what's going on in the wind section. And very few times does everyone need to roll on suspended cymbal at the same time.
Yeah.
Like maybe twice in the whole entire show, maybe.
And it's the end.
And it's at the very end.
Yeah.
That's the number one, mistake that I see around there is way too much suspended cymbal.
So it's almost like you're learning by studying other scores, you're learning just these little like rules kind of like they did this here with this and I liked it. So I'm going to write that down and keep it in my notes and do that when I see appropriate. So you said you listened a lot. Would you like listen and then try to come up with your own little, like what would sound good with it?
Sort of. Yeah. And now, you know, I'll use like voice memo on my phone and, you know, I'll play where I am and record that and then just kind of hum like a little counter melody or, an ostinato idea to go underneath something, or just talk. I'll just talk through it and say, you know, maybe right here, you know, everyone's just playing dead stroke half notes and it's more, we have texture going on with, you know, tambourine and triangle and, get out of the way at this point and sort of give broad strokes through the whole thing and then come back and fill in the details later. Like get an idea for what's going to go on in every different phrase before trying to put down notes.
Now, I'm sure you get a section done and then you're like, I don't like that. Or like, it doesn't that, work. Yeah.
Cause sometimes, you know, I've definitely fallen into the trap of I'll completely write out an entire phrase and orchestrate it. And then I'll skip around to another spot, like whatever speaks to me first. And that's, I think that can be good, but sometimes that'll end up with, oh man, it's this color. It's way too much of the wood texture. And then I'm doing that and same thing in the next phrase. And then I'm doing it again and it needs to switch to metallic. And you don't have enough variation in there. So go through and map out different color choices and, you know, what needs to be doubled, what doesn't need to be doubled before filling in everything.
Yeah. And that's what I'll say. One thing, that's one thing that I'll do and is nice about, you know, not having to like do this on staff paper anymore. But you can go through and like, you know, use Sibelius and make text boxes or whatever for yourself. Like you can do that for yourself and then you're going in and deleting that stuff before you actually send parts and a score and everything. But yeah, this is, I'm really interested in this because I was never in a front ensemble. But I do a little bit of front ensemble arranging really just for my own school. The rest of the stuff I do is battery writing. But I'm always trying to get better ideas just because I feel like I have a really good grasp on what sounds good, you know, as far as creating different textures within the battery and pairing, you know, oh, like it's kind of like one of those things. There are also very few times when like all three battery sections need to be playing all, right. You know, it's like, I mean, probably more so than your suspended cymbals, but not all the time. It's like usually two of the three will do it, or even just one. So finding those textures that make sense together, but I don't have as much of a grasp on that for front ensemble, and it just because I've done it a lot less. And so I really like your idea of, you know, finding somebody that has been doing this longer than you and has had some success and doing some score study. That also makes that like put, you know, that makes you do some work too. It's not like that mm-hmm. instant gratification of like, hey, can you make me better at this? It's like, well, I can help you get there, but it's something that you have to chip away at, you know, every season.
Yeah. And I'm still doing that. Asking for scores from people, and that have been doing it longer. Like, you know, I know some guys who write for DCI groups, and every now and then I'll be like, hey, would you mind sending me a score to that movement of that show? I was really intrigued. I don't know how you created that sound. And, you know, I've been doing arranging for 20 years at this point, but I'm still trying to find people who are better at it that are willing to share.
Yeah. Well, cool. Those are all really good thoughts. I know we're kind of getting close on time here. So this question kind of goes along with arranging, you know, you're also a very accomplished composer. So I wanted to talk about percussion ensemble for a little bit, if we've got time. So I know that was one that we mentioned as a possible topic. But I kind of wanted to ask, how does, and this is, you know, this has the buzzword in it, how does your perspective as a composer change the way you see like writing for percussion ensemble?
Yeah. I mean,
it's like you're a percussionist. So that definitely you have like a view of percussion ensemble just from playing percussion ensemble, but then you also are a composer. So I'm just curious if that changes the way you look at percussion ensemble or not, or if it changes how you approach writing for it.
Yeah. You know, the back half of the time I was teaching full time, where after I had been writing percussion ensemble music, I definitely started to look at it differently as a teacher, and taking that both ways, where as a teacher, I would look at a score and, you know, I might think, well, you know, really that's probably too many people playing toms on this section or whatever. And not be afraid to make some tweaks or to cut some stuff out here and there or add some things, you know, because it wasn't maybe conveying what the piece needed. And then vice versa. When I'm writing music, I'm thinking of it from a teaching perspective and what's going to be, okay, this is what I really want to hear. But then, you know, it's like, it's really not playable, or, you know, physically it's very uncomfortable to get to that. And so I'll either like type in extra notes to the player in the part, or go back and change it and come up with a better idea. I definitely am of the perspective of like, if my music is not, there it is. if the music is not, I want everything I write to be useful. I don't want it to be some pie in the sky, unplayable, only sounds good in Sibelius kind of a thing. I always try to think of it as a teacher and, you know, what can be taught? What's worth spending this much time on? It better be good if it's going to be this complicated. And I've made that mistake in some of my earlier pieces. And so now I think of it more often that way.
Yeah, I like that. That's how I don't compose nearly the amount that you do. It's something that I want to get more into, but it's just like really hard to find the time to do it and to find the energy to do it. And, but yeah, it's like when you are writing, you want to make sure it's like, it has to be educational too. And like the teacher in you, probably wants that. It's like, well, we really need something that's just creating time here, but it's like, but if I write this part where this kid just plays the same rhythm, the same ostinato rhythm on triangle for like 68 measures, like that's not, you know, like we're I programmed a piece right now that we're starting on if we don't have a blizzard or whatever this week. And it's a fantastic piece, but there's one part in it that just sucks. And it's like,
explicit rating.
Yep, there it is.
Yeah, there it is. There's one part in it that is just horrible. And it's like, I guess I'm going to rewrite that one part, you know, because I don't want to give that to a kid. Or it's like, I'm going to make sure that that kid gets in like a quartet or something where they have something else where they're working on. And it's like, you're just going to join us like a week before the concert, because there's there's really no reason for me to take up your time with rehearsal for this. And that's always painful as like a teacher, where it's like, you really like a piece, but there's something where it's like, you feel like you're wasting a kid's time, you know, by having them play a certain part. So yeah, I can appreciate that a lot. And probably a lot of performers can appreciate, you know, composers with some compassion on them. I'm sure you've played some really boring, repetitive parts too.
Yeah. And I also think that same line of thinking can apply to dynamics in a concert band piece, where, you know, older stuff, older music, it's like everybody, if you look down the score, everybody has forte at measure 29.
Yep.
It's like, well, do you really want this snare drum playing forte? I know the answer is no.
Yeah.
And I try to really think about that. I try to like pre-balance for the teacher. And this is a forte moment, but I'm only going to put mezzo forte on this particular instrument because I know it's going to be too much if they actually play forte. And try to think of, you know, with the educator in mind.
Are you composing anything right now? Like, are you working on anything other than arranging?
Oh yeah.
I am. Yeah. So right now I'm doing another large scale percussion orchestra piece for TCU, Texas Christian University.
No way. Cool.
Brian West there, he's like the grand poupah of large percussion orchestra. He's awesome. And so that's what I'm doing right now. I'm doing less marching band arranging, way less, so that I can spend more time working on this.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that is really awesome. Actually, the piece I was talking about was a piece that was commissioned by TCU.
There's a lot of those out there.
There are, yeah. Well, that's cool, man. I'd be really excited to hear that whenever it is
played
out and they have a recording of it and stuff. Whenever it's played, yeah.
Cool. Well, I think this is our time.
Yeah, literally. Right at our time. It's like,
oh yeah, you're right.
That
flew by.
Yeah, I did. I definitely want to do this again. I feel like there's more to chat about with you, and unless you're scared of us now.
Yeah, he's like, not so much.
I'll have to look at my schedule.
Yeah.
I don't know. No, I would love to. I love talking shop. I miss being in the classroom and teaching percussion every day. And so any chance to really, you know, dive deep and talk about why and how, I love it. So
yeah,
thanks for having me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks for being on. It was a good time. And I learned a ton. So, and I hopefully if I learned stuff, then I know there are other people out there that can learn stuff too. I'm not that great at learning. So.
All right. Well, thank you, Adam.
Thanks guys. Yeah, it was really fun.
We'll see y'all in the next one.
Later.
Thank you.